Before we dive into today's discussion, we've got a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world, where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get on with today's show.
From now until the end of December, tune in to Premier Christmas Radio and experience the hope, peace, love and joy that only the sounds of Christmas can bring. Enjoy hours of Christmas music, classic carols and festive favourites. Listen now on the Premier Plus app or your smart speaker. Premier Christmas Radio, the real sound of Christmas, in association with Open Doors.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're pleased to welcome back to the show for the second time, Julie Maxwell. How are you, Julie?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. Good to be with you again.
You last came on about 18 months ago. I think it was summer last year. But for those who don't remember, would you mind briefly introducing yourself and the various different pies you have fingers in?
Yes, so I'm Julie Maxwell. I have worked for over 20 years as a community paediatrician, although I have recently given up my registration and given that up to work for a Christian charity called Lovewise, which I've been working with for about 10, 15 years. But I've taken on working as deputy director of the charity. So we seek to support churches, parents, schools, youth leaders to teach children about sex, marriage, relationships from a Christian, from a biblical perspective. And I'm also on the Church of England General Synod and also work in my local church doing youth work and children's work and women's work. And I've recently also started doing the Cornhill training programme. So I'm doing one
of them. You're a very busy person. Yeah.
But we should explain, for those who aren't familiar with the lingo, General Synod is nothing to do with the military. It's a kind of governing assembly of the Church of England, which has a slightly eccentric name.
I was just thinking, Julie, most people, I think, would know what a community paediatrician is and does, but I think there will be some people who don't. And it is a particularly important role in the UK and in the NHS. So perhaps if you could just say a bit more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I knew particularly what it was before I kind of fell into it as a career. Wasn't my intended career. But as a community paediatrician, I was involved mainly in working with children with additional needs, diagnosing autism, ADHD, and my particular special interest was in language disorders, so particularly preschool children who had language difficulties and social communication difficulties as well. And I think it was partly that and my Lovewise which got me interested in the whole gender dysphoria area. So I was sort of seeing it at work and seeing the sort of difference between biological reality and what was sort of going on with young people.
And community paediatricians tend to come from a particular sort of mindset, which is the idea that we're here. I did a bit for some in part of my training. You know, the idea that we're here for the children who are sometimes need an advocate. They need, you know, they are vulnerable. We're battling against, you know, the schools to get proper provision for the child with their various disabilities. We're battling to get proper care in the hospitals, in the community, you know, whatever it is. The paediatricians see themselves as there for, and these children are often very complicated, aren't they? Have multiple different mental health, social problems, medical problems, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the important things in community paediatrics is seeing them in the context of their family, their school, their environment, and all the ways that sort of plays into what their difficulties might be. So it's not a, in many ways, it's not a particularly medical speciality. It's quite, and there's a lot of, sort of crossover with mental health services and all sorts of other services as well, schools, psychologists, all of that kind of thing. So it's quite a unique speciality, but I got into it because it fitted in with my family life better than acute medicine.
And when we had you on last, Julie, we wanted to in particular talk about the treatment of children who are kind of questioning their gender, and in particular the kind of controversy around issues such as, you know, prescribing puberty blockers, which there was an enormous debate in the UK at the time. And I'd recommend if people are interested in this topic, do go back in the feed and search out. I think it was June 2023 when Julie was last on. Really helpful conversation exploring some of the medical and then kind of theological and ethical aspects of that. But there's been quite a dramatic developments, haven't there, in the story, at least here in the UK, since you were last on, which is primarily that an official NHS review was published, known as the Cass Review, after its author, Hilary Cass. Could you explain a little bit about what Hilary Cass was asked to investigate, what she concluded, and what changes that has had in the treatment of gender questioning children?
Yeah, so I mean, I think when I came on last time, we were already seeing some of the effects of the review, because the review took, I think it was 4 years. I sort of lost in my mind where, but I think it took about 4 years. It took a lot longer than it was expected to take. But basically, partly because there was such an increase in young people, particularly teenage girls, presenting with gender dysphoria, and the services just couldn't cope with it, and there was starting to be concerns around what was going on. So they commissioned this independent review. So NHS England commissioned it, and Hilary Cass is an eminent paediatrician, previous president of the Royal College of Paediatrics. She was tasked with this enormous job, which was enormous, and there was a number of things kind of changed, I think, in the meantime. So even before the final report was released, the Department for Education in December, so a year ago, produced some guidance for schools, draft guidance for schools on how to support children who are questioning their gender. So that very much pulled on what was beginning to come out from the Cass Review. And then the final report was produced in April. It was very long. But I would recommend anyone who's interested to actually read it, because there is some really, really interesting and good stuff in the report.
And overall, is it fair to say the headline is she was quite critical of the way the NHS was currently treating children with gender dysphoria, which was all through one single clinic here in London?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was one of the sort of big criticisms that kind of came out that was levelled at the Tavistock Clinic, was that it was a single service that had kind of grown up kind of organically rather than with the sort of the usual safeguards that would be there for medical services, particularly services in paediatrics. And it was kind of, I think in the review she talks about, or somebody talks about it being a sort of a social justice model rather than an evidence-based clinical practice, which is not how the NHS and services are supposed to work, and that the sort of the protocol for treating children with gender dysphoria with puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones was something that was kind of done with no real evidence that it was the right thing to do, and it wasn't kind of, yeah, it wasn't done in the usual way, which is a huge concern for any medical treatment, but particularly one that has such life-changing effects on a child and on their future.
And wasn't it also true that she pointed out that very many of the children who were questioning their gender had multiple other pathologies, so-called, you know, issues, some medical, some mental health, some social, and that the normal model would, in the community paediatrician, would be to involve all the specialists involved in these different aspects. But because these children were gender affirming, they were treated in a different way, and the other issues were ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I mean, and I saw cases of that within my clinical practice where children, you know, often children in care, children who had numerous mental health problems, abuse in their past, trauma, as soon as they kind of mentioned anything to do with gender, everything else was just ignored. And it was only the gender that was dealt with. And that was something that kind of came out very much in the criticisms of the Tavistock Clinic, that and partly because I think clinicians were afraid to do it. So, you know, one of the things that it was said in the report was that there was this pressure on professionals to just adopt an affirmative approach, to just kind of go along with the gender identity rather than questioning and do it, you know. And many, particularly paediatricians that I've spoken to, have been very uncomfortable with doing that, but have felt they had no option. And that's a really scary place to be, that you're treating children in a way that you don't feel comfortable with, you don't feel is right, but you feel that you've got no choice. And I think there's going to be actually a lot of clinicians and other professionals who are going to be very regretful of things that they've done in the past, and referring children and the way they've handled children, which is very sad.
Because it's true, isn't it, that because the Tavistock was the sole NHS England clinic of treating children who were questioning their gender, it became in the kind of trans community very prominent and well known, and there was a lot of interaction with kind of outside non-medical advocacy groups like Mermaids or Stonewall, who have a very particular kind of, you might even say, a political ideology on how children should be treated. And so the doctors at the clinic were not able in many cases to simply kind of adopt a kind of standard medical approach at looking dispassionately at what does the evidence suggest, what is the best practice recommended in my guidance, how can I treat this child. But they're in this kind of political turmoil swirl of they're getting in the neck from activists. They're trying to live up to their social justice ideals, and it just became very detached from its origins, where it was 20-30 years earlier when the clinic started.
Yeah, and there's, you know, lots of, so the Hannah Barnes book is another really interesting read, which sort of goes through the history of kind of how we got to where we are with the Tavistock. And one of the sort of things that comes out from that is that often they would be very inexperienced clinicians who would join the Tavistock, very enthusiastic to do their best for children, to kind of, you know, help vulnerable, hurting, unhappy children. And then they would sort of throw themselves into it and then would very quickly realise that what they were doing at the Tavistock wasn't helping. And then they would try and whistleblow. And then that's when the problems would start. But yeah, Hannah Barnes has done some amazing kind of looking into what's gone on. And it's a harrowing read in many ways, but I think quite an important read to understand how we got to where we are so that we don't fall into that trap again, and that we can undo what's been done to such a really vulnerable group of children.
One of the common narratives that was used by those in favour of gender, of hormone blockers and so on, was that it was a way of preventing suicide, that there was a very high risk of suicide in these children who were questioning their gender, and that we were saving lives, you know, because there was evidence, it was claimed, that these children, once they were given puberty blockers and cross-gender hormones and so on, that they would then be protected from committing suicide. And I think that was one of the things that came out of the CAST review, wasn't it? That the evidence for that was actually non-existent,
actually. Yeah. So the research that was done as part of the CAST review basically showed no benefits from puberty blockers at all, and obviously then also then cross-sex hormones. So, you know, actually, while people had been, you know, told that this was a sort of a life-saving treatment, and that's certainly the line that comes from, like, say, people like Mermaids and Stonewall and things like that, that actually the evidence just does not back that up. Hilary Cass, you know, also commissioned a systematic review of social transition as well, which again showed no effects. Interestingly, neither positive nor negative, but certainly no positive effects to social transition. But what it did do was make it more likely that the children who had socially transitioned would go on to then have medical treatment, puberty blockers, and cross-sex hormones. Given that the evidence doesn't show any benefit of those either, then the whole process shows no benefit. And then obviously massive concerns about side effects and the kind of the outcomes long term appear to be generally very poor.
For those who are not familiar, yeah. Social transition is, as opposed to medical transition, is when people would start to live as the other gender, maybe changing their pronouns, their names, their clothing, their appearance, but without actually undertaking any kind of medical treatment from, you know, hormones all the way up to surgery. And is often, as you say, was often kind of portrayed as like a no-brainer, obvious first step for these children. Why wouldn't you? This will be a great way of treating their dysphoria. And you're saying that actually that Cass, when she looked at the evidence, there is no evidence that letting children social distance actually makes them feel any better.
No, absolutely. And just makes it more likely that they will continue in that identity. Because what you're doing is you're agreeing with their gender identity. So the Department for Education Guidance for Gender Questioning Children, which was produced in December last year, was very clear, actually, that social transition, ahead of the category, the social transition was a significant intervention, and that the school shouldn't be doing it. So they are very clear in that guidance, which hasn't been put out as a final guidance yet. But they were very clear that primary schools particularly should not be allowing children to use pronouns that were different to their biological sex, and that in secondary schools that they were absolutely allowed to decline requests to do it, and that they would have to think very, very carefully before they did it. So I think it's really important to understand that, like you say, it's not just a no-brainer, it's not just a kind thing to do, it's actually a significant intervention which can affect how that child then develops and how their difficulties develop over time. But it's a difficult area.
And if you stop and think about it, I mean, that's blindingly obvious, isn't it? You know, if little Johnny, who has, you know, been going to primary school and then decides, you know, I'm Joanna and starts dressing differently, you know, the knock-on implications of all that, you know, of the sort of the implications for teachers and for all their classmates and for the parents, and you can see how the ripple effects are absolutely enormous and potentially irreversible. You know, once it's known that little Johnny is little Joanna, I mean, what's the possibility of going back and so on?
Yeah, and I think particularly if that happens to very young children, because, you know, a very young child, if you tell little Johnny that they're actually Joanna, then they will genuinely believe that if they're young. You know, they don't understand, you know, the permanency of sex until they're at least about sort of seven. But, you know, they do believe that if you put on a dress, you become a girl. And so you lead them to believe that they're a girl. And then, of course, when they do get to puberty, then, of course, they're going to be very distressed because they're going to go through what in their mind is the wrong puberty. So you've set them up for significant distress, and that's presumably why they are more likely to go on to medical treatment. But of course, the situation now, since the Cass review, is that they can't just go on to puberty blockers. So whereas before the Cass review, you know, that they could, through the Tavistock, be referred on for puberty blockers, that is now not quite so possible.
So we should explain really what the implications of the Cass review was on the medical side. So the Tavistock has basically been wound down, as far as I understand, and Cass recommended the creation of a regional network of clinics rather than having one national clinic, which would be paediatrics led, but include kind of multidisciplinary teams covering all the various other kind of pathologies that are presenting in these children. Has that started to happen yet?
It has started to happen. I think there are still quite a lot of concerns about that model. There are also a number of problems getting it set up, because the worry is that what you're going to do is just take the problems that were going on in the Tavistock and spread them around the country, and that has been sort of borne out to a certain extent, because those that are sort of wanting to work in those regional centres are often clinicians from the Tavistock. with some, you know, few exceptions that I'm aware of. But so there is significant concern that while there's good things about these regional centres, they'll be hopefully much more holistic, more paediatric led, and kind of consider things from a much wider perspective. I think there is still concern about the sort of ideology around behind the clinicians that are going to be in those services. And also, you know, you kind of have to question, why do we need gender services? You know, why is it not just mental health services generally that I'm looking, you know, I mean, one of the other things that sort of came out in the CAS review was that questions about why there was such a big increase in the number of children presenting, and that actually the availability of services, it's in itself causes an increase, and particularly the availability of puberty blockers, which obviously is now not so available. But, you know, the worry would be for me that if it's easier to access gender services, is that just going to make potentially more of a problem? I don't know. That's just my concern.
Yeah. And I suppose, as you say, if puberty blockers haven't been completely banned for under 16s, but are basically no longer the kind of first port of call, is that right?
So they're no longer routinely available. So they can only be prescribed now as part of a clinical trial. So the clinical trial, as far as I understand it, is yet to be kind of set up. And I mean, I and a number of others have huge kind of questions about whether a clinical trial for this would actually be able to be ethically approved, given the concerns we already have and the evidence that we do already have on puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. But so at the moment you can't access them routinely at all, which you could before. And as far as I understand it, the trial is not yet up and running. When the puberty blockers were initially sort of the routine prescribing was stopped, obviously there was a huge concern because you had a whole cohort of young people who themselves and their parents had been led to believe that puberty blockers was going to be life-saving, that this was the treatment that they needed. And all of a sudden, almost like the rug was pulled out from under them and they were desperate. So many of them went privately and got prescriptions privately. The government then, just before the general election, they issued an emergency ban on private prescriptions of puberty blockers for young people, which was then extended. So that is currently still in place at the moment, even though we've had a change of government. So it's quite an interesting situation.
So the only way you could actually get puberty blockers in the UK right now is if you're prepared to basically go on the internet and buy them from overseas.
Yes. So the emergency ban or the ban covers some overseas stuff, but not all of it. But yeah, so you can buy them on the internet, and people do.
You can see how the idea of doing a research trial makes a lot of sense, but you can also imagine that randomizing children to, you know, how are you going to do that? Is it going to be ethical, as you say?
Yeah.
And how can the children give informed consent for something so dramatic?
Yeah.
And given, as you say, Julie, that there is evidence already in the kind of academic literature that suggests that puberty blockers can cause like lifelong physical harm to bone density and all other kind of things as well. It's, you know, if this wasn't so politically tense, if it was just a completely like apoliticized situation, I find it hard to see how you could ever get ethical approval for giving even half your cohort on the style these drugs.
Yeah. And at this point in the conversation, I think, you know, if the original Tavistock trial had been done properly, and kind of the results, you know, issued properly, then potentially that could have given us some good information. You know, when people genuinely didn't know, you know, when people genuinely thought it was just going to be a pause, that it was just going to relieve distress. You know, if you'd done a trial then, I could see, but I personally can't see how you could ethically do it or get informed consent at this point, but I don't know.
And if puberty blockers are basically no longer on the cards, what are these new clinics going to be offering? Is it just talking therapy and psychotherapy, basically? There's no medical treatment available now for gender questioning children who are pre-puberty.
Yeah, and I guess, given that we know that there are so many underlying mental health conditions, trauma, autism, ADHD, bullying, all sorts of things that can be the sort of cause or contributing factors to gender dysphoria, then those are the things that need to be, addressed. So, you go back to the community paediatrics, really, the holistic, what's going on in the family, what's going on for this child, what are their difficulties, what's going on in school, all of those things that are around them. And there's also huge implications with social media. So, the CATA review, there's quite an interesting section where she talks about the role of social media and pornography. So particularly teenage girls, they don't want what they kind of see as being a woman, as what they're going to have to kind of do or be as a woman. So they kind of want to opt out. And flip side, actually teenage boys who kind of maybe see pornography, see some of the sort of extreme, what's sometimes called toxic masculinity. I don't like that phrase because it kind of implies that being male is toxic, which clearly it's not. But some of the sort of ways that people feel like they're expected to behave, you can see why teenagers would want to opt out of being the sort of sexualized version of a woman that they're seeing expected, or that boys don't want to be the kind of man that they might have seen in pornography or whatever. So that's an interesting kind of aspect of it as well, as to what might be underlying things.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because what seems to be happening is that in some ways, on this particular issue of how we respond to children with gender questioning, the UK has become an outlier. I mean, maybe the UK and Sweden are, I understand, the two places that have become outliers from a medical point of view compared with the rest of the world. But of course, internet culture is completely global. Mm. Internet culture doesn't understand that there might be differences between different countries. So you can imagine that if these children are all on social media, the fact that this is being managed in a different way in the UK doesn't protect them from all the other forces that are operating in an opposite direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other important thing to remember about social media is algorithms. So, what I see on my social media feed and what you see on your social media feed will be completely different to what your average teenage girl who's questioning their gender will see on their social media feed. So, the CATA review is a really interesting example. So the comments on the CATA review that I would see would say completely different things to what a teenage friend would see about the CAST review. They would see that it's this dreadful thing that's, against trans people, and that it's
going to kill people, yeah.
And of course they genuinely believe that because that's what they're being told by the people they trust. So we have to remember that as well. So it's not only different countries and international, but actually it's that people with different views will see completely different things.
As we approach the end of the year, I want to take a moment to reflect on the incredible work God has done through Premier Insight in 2024. This year, we've launched new podcasts like Rico Tice's and provided impactful books and resources, and we've shared the powerful N.T. Wright videos to help people grow in wisdom and share their faith with clarity and compassion. But this ministry wouldn't be possible without you. Your generosity has equipped countless believers to live out their faith. Right now, we face a $112,129 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st to sustain this vital work. Your gift today will not only help us finish this year strong, but also lay the foundation for exciting plans we have for 2025. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. Together, let's make an eternal impact for God's kingdom. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this leads us to the kind of education side of it as well, because what I think is becoming clearer through Cass and other evidence is that, there is evidence of kind of clusters of gender dysphoria spreading within friendship circles, both in real person in school, but also through kind of parasocial relationships people develop online and social media platforms, which shouldn't really be surprising to us because this is how teenagers have always operated. You know, they have trends, they have fads, they have interests, they're highly influenced by their peers. And, you know, so to put crudely, you know, if one teenage girl in a group decides that she's now a he or starts to socially transition, it's not unusual for over time for more of their friends and peers, particularly when they see, you know, the attention and the care and the status that is lavished upon you for being so brave and coming out as trans at 13 or whatever. It's unsurprising that ripples kind of around social networks. And that suggests that schools and people leading and teaching in schools have a massive role to play here in how do we care for appropriately and sensitively these kind of children. So you mentioned the government here in the UK came out with some draft guidance, which was kind of rowing back on social transition and urging schools to be a bit more less credulous, shall we say. But that was then called up by the general election, and we now have a really new government from the left-leaning Labour Party. Have they said what they're going to do? Are they going to adopt the previous guidance or they start from scratch?
I don't know is the answer. They're sort of, you kind of get one person, Morgan, who might say something in one way, and then somebody might say, I think my understanding would be that there are some very difficult discussions going on that people can't agree. Because I think, you know, this is an issue where you kind of can't be in the middle. You either go one way or the other, which makes for very difficult discussions, because you've got people who just kind of can't agree. But so, you know, so you had this, you know, the gender questioning guidance came out in December, and then we had the RSE, relationship sex education guidance, which came out in May, which again is out for consultation, went out for consultation, and we haven't heard back, you know. And there was one particular bit in there which talked about teaching facts about biological sex and not using any materials that present contested views as facts. I mean, that would be huge. If that could come in and school, I mean, you wouldn't think that was huge, really, would you? That schools would teach facts, not contested ideology. But you know, sadly, you know, I hear every day still of schools that are teaching gender identity as fact and teaching that sex can be on a spectrum, and you know, not teaching facts. I mean, I think at the very least, schools need to make sure they're teaching facts. And I think another concern in schools is this kind of phenomenon of LGBT clubs. So many schools now will have LGBT clubs as safe spaces for those who perceive themselves as lesbian, gay, transgender. And that they are massively implicated as well in people coming to have a trans identity. So often they'll join these clubs because they struggle with friendships, and it's somewhere where they sort of can sort of, you know, meet people, and they will often then sort of start saying, you know, it's a story I've heard time and time again, start saying that they're perhaps bisexual, because being heterosexual is a bit boring these days. So they might say they're bisexual, then they'll say they're non-binary, and then they'll say they're transgender, and there's, you know, and like you said, there's this sort of slight, almost like celebrity culture type thing around identifying as transgender very often in schools. But these clubs are not helpful. And they're often either supervised by an activist teacher or they're not supervised at all. They are very worrying. And parents will often say that this has been something, along with social media, that's implicated in their teenage girl or teenage boy declaring a trans identity.
You know, it's again fascinating, isn't it? Because this is a bit of a sort of micro reflection of these huge issues going on in society as a whole, isn't it? And one of the problems, I'm afraid, is with the word facts, because, you know, in a postmodern culture, there ain't no such thing. There are just your facts and my facts, and you know, we differ as to what the facts are, and your facts have all been taken from legacy media and homophobic doctors, and my facts have been taken from progressive, well-informed, and alternative views And, you know, and you're telling me that I have to teach children the facts. I mean, well, I choose what those facts are, don't I?
Yeah, absolutely. We're in a post-truth world, aren't we?
But then what? That was what I found so refreshing about Cass, was that it was a conscious rejection and saying, hang on, we've been treating this issue like it's a piece of politics, like it's a, and you have red team and blue team, you have left and right hammering it out, hammering tongs, conservatives and liberals, progressives and traditionalists. And she said, no, hang on, this is medicine, this is science, there is truth and there is untruth, and there is evidence and there is no evidence, and the job of doctors is to put all the politics to one side and focus on objective evidence. And by the way, there is no evidence that giving gender questioning children puberty blockers is good for them. And actually, you know, obviously there were the usual Stonewall mermaid voices shrieking about homophobia, but you can't really credibly accuse Hillary Cass of being some kind of latent bigot. She's actually produced an incredibly weighty piece of research that is really kind of unassailable if you're interested in truth. And I think it's been really refreshing watching from the outside, as very much not an expert on any of this as a doctor or as a political activist, seeing people start to move, take, you know, come down the hill from their deeply entrenched political perspectives and say, oh no, hang on, there is actually such a thing as objective reality. Now, obviously, it gets more blurry when you move out of the realm of medicine and science into kind of the social side, and it's harder to establish what is fact. But I think, and it feels to me that perhaps the we've hit the peak of the kind of, I can basically, through force of will alone, magic up new realities by stating things like sex is not a binary. And people are like, oh, no, actually, but, you know, that's either true or it's untrue. It's not really something that's up for grabs on a kind of case by case, you know, your truth, my truth basis. There either is a sex binary or there isn't. Do you sense that there has been a kind of slight return to truth?
Yeah, and I think so. And I think, you know, I mean, we're seeing it in sport, aren't we? You know, we're seeing, a real pushback. Exactly. You know, people are like, you know, actually, you know, this just...
Men do run faster than women. It's a thing.
Yeah. And men are stronger than women. And men, you know, if men compete against women, they win or they hurt women, you know, and, you know, in a whole sort of, you know, men in women's spaces kind of thing. You know, I think, you know, I think we are starting to see that, but I think people are still afraid. And I think that, and I think to a certain extent, schools, I think, is where people are still very afraid. And there's still less willingness to perhaps push back than there is, you know, in the wider world perhaps. But I think people are becoming more willing to voice their concerns and voice their sort of, you know, no, actually there are men and there are women, and you know, you can't move from one to the other.
Yeah, and actually I'm quite sort of quietly proud of British paediatrics and British medical philosophy, because if I was asked to sort of try to verbalize the way that British medicine as a whole operates compared to medicine across the world, I would say we've got much more of an emphasis on kind of just being commonsensical. And there's a kind of medical pragmatism about, oh, for goodness sake, let's just do something that works. But there's also a real commitment to trying to be evidence-based, you know, that this whole movement of trying to look for the evidence has been very influential in the UK. And so this is a kind of combination. I think Hillary Cass is a nice combination of let's just look for the evidence, let's do a proper analysis, and then a kind of commonsensical, well, hang on a minute, they've got all these other problems, you know, shouldn't we be dealing with those as well? And I think it's just interesting that paediatricians in most countries are so affected by the politics and by the social media. I mean, particularly if they're operating in a private arena where this is also their livelihood. And that if they were to take an unpopular line openly, it could destroy their livelihood. They operate therefore in a different way.
I think it is interesting though, and I agree with you, John. But I think you know, there was recently the BMA voted to or kind of voted on disavowing the Cass review. So I think
This is the kind of trade union for doctors in the UK.
Yes, yes. I mean, I gave up my membership a long time ago because of their views on abortion. But so I haven't been part of it for a long time. But I think, you know, it showed the strength of the voice of the sort of left wing, I suppose, if there's such a thing. But, you know, the sort of the liberal voices that have very much, they are very loud, and the sort of ideology that has captured a lot of the NHS, a lot of public bodies generally. But I think, so, you know, there has been a lot of medical pushback. I mean, even in, there's been a couple of really worrying articles in the Royal College of Paediatrics publications that still are very much the sort of ideology, social justice model rather than evidence-based. So I think I agree, and I think we're in a much better position than many countries, but I think there is still a long way to go. And I mean, Hilary Cass herself, you know, she had threats. She was told not to go on public transport because, you know, she was worried people were going to attack her. I mean, it's just horrendous. But I suppose that comes back to this kind of truth thing, isn't it? Because if they can't attack your truth, because it is truth, they attack people personally and people's credibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a number of complaints against me when I was still working. But, you know, people attacking my credibility rather than my medical competency.
And we should say, you know, the UK is not the only country that's kind of questioning this, you know, and I think some of the Scandinavian countries have drawn similar conclusions about, you know, and are withdrawing puberty blockers for under 18s. But at the same time, in the United States, where so much of the kind of trans movement's strength lies and where a lot of the identity flows from, there are still vast swathes of the American healthcare system, you know, which is obviously completely fragmented as a private system, where it's absolutely standard and routine for children, even in primary school age, to be put on puberty blockers. And so I think it's easy for us in the UK to be like, okay, that was a kind of crazy 10, 20 years, but we rode back, we realized our mistake, and now we're heading back to evidence. But actually, that isn't the case, isn't it? In large parts of the Western world, including lots of people will be listening to this podcast from states in America where that remains, you know, your child could, after one or two meetings, you know, saying that they feel like the other gender, be put on blockers.
And of course, you know, what we, even if this kind of turns around, and even if the Labour government agree to the gender questioning guidance for schools and all this, even if we turn this around right now, we've still got a whole cohort of young people who have come through school being taught that gender identity is a thing, that you can choose whether you're male or female, that you can be something different to what your body tells you. So that's going to take a long time to kind of unpick that. And we've also got the fact that while all this is sort of now relatively clear for you know, under 16 year olds, the sort of 17, 18 year olds can go straight to adult services. Now, following on from the CAS review, there is now going to be a sort of a similar look into what's being done for adults in gender services, but actually it's all part and parcel of the same thing. So, you know, I talk to many parents whose teenagers are heading to 16, 17, and they're terrified now that they're going to take themselves off to the adult gender clinics and be able to be put on cross-sex hormones, and nobody's going to stop them.
So Tim's a parent, I am a grandparent, you know, Tim's daughter is about to enter mainstream education. What kind of advice would you give to parents of children who are in education or about to enter education? What can we do here and now to try to address these issues?
I mean, I think as parents, particularly as Christian parents, I think, you know, our big responsibility is to teach our children biological and biblical facts, so that we, you know, so we're making sure that they've got really good foundations of truth and fact right from a young age, and that we need to keep on doing that as they go into school. I think what, as children go to school as well, we need to be really aware that, you know, back when my children were young, sex education was kind of one lesson in the summer term in year six. You could pull them out quite easily, teach them, you know, facts and the Bible. Now it's throughout the curriculum. So, you know, from nurseries with books about Teddy can become is a boy, but is become a girl, two mums, two dads, all of that kind of LGBT stuff is right through the curriculum. So it is almost impossible to protect your children, but it's a matter of asking the questions, seeing what's in the school library, constantly working out what they're being taught in school, and just kind of, being on it so that you can combat it and make sure that you're teaching them truth, even if they're not at school. And that's really hard, because children tend to, if they're taught it at school, they 100% believe it. Particularly as they get older, if school said it and it's different to what you as parents are saying, school must be right, not parents. And we need to make sure that they trust us as parents, that actually we're right, not necessarily the schools.
It's really interesting, this conversation, because I literally just a week ago had a really interesting, or was kind of eavesdropping on an interesting conversation about a young person who had grown up in a Christian household. And then when they had got to their kind of mid-teens, had suddenly realized that the way of life and their values and worldview and everything they'd been told was at dramatically at odds with their friends at school, and started to question that, and have now, don't really go to church and feel, the word that they used was kind of indoctrination. And I think obviously I disagree. And I think it is a duty of Christian parents to raise their children, teaching us what we think is best for them, what is truth, whether that's what the Bible says or, the fact that there are two genders. But I think it's an interesting question. How do we do that sensitively and thoughtfully in a way that doesn't leave our children? Because I think some Christian parents just want to build a cocoon around their children and say, I'm just going to keep them in this safe space where their only influence and their only source of authority is me. But there's a time limit on that can only last so long, and then they will be butting up against radically different worldviews, completely different sets of values and sources of authority. How do we prepare them for that in a way that doesn't make them look back at us and be like, oh, you were just brainwashing me all this time, Dad?
I think it's two things in that, isn't it? Because obviously, yes, we do often get accused of indoctrination, don't we? But if something is true, it's not indoctrination, is it? We don't indoctrinate children to understand that 2 + 2 = 4, because it is. So there's an element to which, if it's true, in a post-truth world, that's quite difficult. But if it's true, it's not indoctrination. So that's kind of one thing. And the other thing is that, as parents, yes, that, that is our job, isn't it? So there's a... depending on your child's age and their abilities and all the rest of it, there is a point at which you do just protect them. So, that's why we have age ratings on films, and we have limits on, being able to access social media, because children need to be protected. We don't let 3-year-olds cross the road, because they need to be protected until they're ready to be able to do it themselves. So there is an element that we do need to protect them up until an age where they are able to understand, yes, different people have a different view. My parents have a Christian worldview, and it is that kind of tension between the Christian worldview and a secular worldview, isn't it? But that children are only ready to begin to kind of address that at a certain age, really.
Yeah, I think that is the key, and I think it is a delicate balance about trying to work out at what age your child is old enough to understand that some people have different ideas. And I tend to think it's better to do that earlier rather than later. And that's I think one of the dangers of overemphasizing the you've just got to educate your children, blah blah blah, because I think part of educating your children is helping them to understand that actually there are people who will think differently things, and let's put that on the table rather than try to hide the fact that there are people who come to different conclusions. I think within reason and at a certain stage of development, it's much better to put them on the table. And actually, I can recall conversations we used to have around the table, Tim, but more at a kind of adolescent sort of stage, I think, when I actually quite enjoyed playing devil's advocate and saying, well, some people say God doesn't exist, and it's a whole lot of, and it's a whole lot of phooey, and you're all religiously indoctrinated. What would you say to that? You know, and actually, rather than, you know, horror, there are people who don't agree with us. Actually, much better to put it on the table.
And that gives you, in theory, you know, when you know, the sad truth is at some point your children become adults and you no longer can control them and watch over them. You have to send them out into the big bad world themselves. I guess the theory is that leaves them best equipped to handle the kind of, you know, if they're going off to university or into the workplace, the absolute kind of welter of different opinions and thoughts they will have, rather than cocooning them until they're 18, only for them to suddenly be shocked to discover that some people do have two dads and I didn't know that was a thing, and how am I going to handle this truth or this reality, even if I think it's not how I want to live my life or whatever.
But I think there's, you know, there is a real danger in addressing these things too young. You know, so if you've got a 4-year-old, for example, then, you know, obviously they can't comprehend that. And the problem with some of this sort of, you know, the trans, but also some of the, LGB stuff as well, is that in an effort to teach young children about it, they have to simplify it so much that children genuinely believe that two men can have a baby, or that two women can have a baby, and they genuinely believe that a boy can become a girl, and that it's all very straightforward, and it's all, you know, and this I think is the problem, is, you know, discussing different people think different things when you're teenagers is a very different kettle of fish to 5-year-olds being kind of read storybooks, and being taught this stuff as fact. I think those are two quite different things, and it's much easier to counteract and to discuss and protect a teenager than it is a 5-year-old.
And this, you know, I've had lots of conversations in recent years with, you know, Christian friends who are kind of got children going into primary school age, who are seriously thinking about, you know, do I want to homeschool my children? Shall I look for a private Christian school so that they're more shielded from some of the influences? And again, you know, there's no right or wrong answer to those questions. That's quite a personal decision. I don't personally think there's much merit. I wouldn't want to go down the homeschooling route for a number of reasons. But I do think, absolutely, as you said, Julie, there's an incumbency on us as parents, even of primary school age kids, to be very engaged. You know, as you say, go and chat to the teachers at your school and say, could I read the curriculum to see what? Just out of curiosity, you know, I'd be interested to know what you're teaching my children about gender and marriage and reproduction and these other big questions, because, you know, this is not something you only tackle in secondary school, is it? And maybe I think there used to be the presumption that, you know, this is all something we deal with at the difficult teenage years, and you have the birds and the bees. But actually, as you say, maybe we need to be much more clued up as parents when our children are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know, going into the school library, meeting with the teachers, asking to read curriculums. And it doesn't have to be in this kind of super hostile, hectoring tone. It just says, I'm curious. I would love to know what my child is learning. Just because that helps them that helps you figure out what you need to say and do at home.
There are a lot of Church of England schools and other Christian schools. I'd be quite interested to know what's your opinion, Julie, of how they're managing to navigate this minefield.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So, I mean, there are, you know, a lot of particularly primary schools, a lot of them are Church of England schools. And certainly in my experience with, you know, a number of parents that I've dealt with, they've deliberately put their children in Church of England schools because they thought they would be protected from some of this gender ideology. Where, in fact, it certainly appears that Church of England schools are at least as bad as other schools at teaching some of this stuff, if not worse in some cases. Certainly there are lots of, stories, that makes it sound like it's made up. There are lots of parents reporting things that have been taught in Church of England schools, and that they, you know, are not... you know, certainly they're teaching gender ideology and they are allowing children to socially transition. I mean, you know, there was the quite high profile case, wasn't there, on the Isle of Wight a number of years ago, where parents took their children out of the school because there were children identifying, I was a child identifying as transgender, and they kind of felt that, you know, they didn't want to expose their child to that. And it's not an isolated case. There are many, many, and I've heard a number of not Christian parents who are very unhappy with the way that the Church of England schools have dealt with it, and seem to be reluctant to take on the recommendations from the CAS review, really, which is a concern, certainly for many parents. But you know, there are an increasing number of independent Christian schools who I think would be more willing to teach kind of fact rather than ideology. But I think people feel under a lot of threat, and they feel that they are, you know, put themselves potentially in the line of attack if they don't go along with gender ideology. I think that's still a big concern in schools.
There's a real complicating thing, isn't it, about church schools here in England in particular, because so many of them, as you say, have this kind of historic church foundation and basis, but they have been for, you know, approaching a century now, effectively kind of funded by the taxpayer and run by the state or by the local education authority. And so you're left with this kind of muddy middle ground where they often talk about their Christian ethos, you know, and they might have a Bible verse on the website somewhere, and the local vicar will be the chair of the governors. But in actual real sense, the head teacher and many of the teachers are almost certainly going to be no different to the teachers you might find in a completely secular school. They're church schools, not in name only, that would be unfair, but there is a kind of weird grey area for some of them. And for some of them, the church ethos is very significant, and, you know, they might look to the Church of England to give them a lead on some of their, you know, ethics and approach to education. But there are other ones for whom it's a kind of little more than a name badge outside and doesn't actually... And so you can't tell as a parent when you are looking at Church of England schools, oh, it's got C of E in the name, therefore... It's everything it does will be consonant with what the church teaches, even if you agreed with that, which obviously many Christians would have some queries about some of the things the Anglican Church believes. So, yeah, I just think it's a very complicated part of our super eccentric, evolved over many centuries education system here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, the Church of England produced some guidance on anti-bullying guidance, which came, the sort of final draft of part of it came out in July. And it's quite an interesting document, interesting, maybe, I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it's quite an interesting document in that it is very much based on the sort of critical theory, intersectionality, that sort of, you know, social justice model, rather than really on biblical principles, which, you know, you might expect from church, from the church. And I think that is, you know, it's just like you were saying, Tim, I think, you know, a lot of church schools are church in name only, and they are, you know, kind of just has maybe a little Christian flavour to basically what is going on in the rest of the society, just with a little hint of Christian flavour, maybe.
Do you think, just as the last one on this, do you think that Christians should be kind of en masse opting out of the state sector and investing massively in building up a network of private schools? I mean, I know there are lots of private Christian schools, but they're not in every part of the country. They're not always affordable. Do you think it would be a good or a bad thing if Christian parents were to kind of try to opt out en masse and build up a separate independent network of education?
I mean, I think certainly my experience over the sort of years that, you know, my kids are all adults now, but, you know, given that when they were at school, it was relatively possible to protect them from some of this stuff. And I think it is very, very difficult now. So certainly if my children were younger now, even though I previously wasn't a big fan of either private education or homeschooling, I think given what I know about what goes on in schools now, I would be likely, I think, to seriously consider either homeschooling, might have killed me, but... or they might not have survived, one or the other, or looking for a Christian school, because I think it is just the environment we're in now means that having any kind of Christian principles is in schools is difficult. I mean, my children went to a Catholic secondary school, which wasn't great, wasn't perfect by any stretch, but it retained that clear kind of Christian ethos where we were allowed to go, you know, as Lovewise, I used to go in and teach about marriage, teach about saving sex for marriage, teach, you know, which you couldn't have done in a secular school or even in a Church of England school, almost certainly, certainly in my area. I used to go and teach Lovewise in Church of England primary schools, and I'm now not allowed to. I can only go into the Catholic primary schools because they're the only ones who are willing to have their children taught biological reality and about marriage. So my big recommendation, I think, for parents would be if they have children who are struggling with questioning their gender, is the Bayswater Support Group. So that is not a Christian organisation, but there are Christians in it, and they support parents who have trans-identifying children. So that's where I always point parents to. That is a really helpful, and obviously Lovewise resources. And I wrote an article for Affinity last year. I can send you the link. I think it's called Parenting in a Gender Confused World or something like that.
All right. Well, we're going to have to draw it to a close there. But thanks so much, Julie. It's been a really interesting conversation. Great to kind of pick up some of the threads from the last time you were on. I'm sure we'll try and get you on maybe in a year or two again, when no doubt this ever-changing world will have changed once more. I do recommend you look up Lovewise. What's the website address for that, Julie?
Lovewise.org.uk.
Great. And we'll pop some other recommendations and resources from Julie in the podcast notes, particularly for parents who might be experiencing this with their own children. We'd love to hear your own thoughts, particularly those who have got children who might have experienced this or kind of thinking about what schools to send. Do get in touch with us with any questions, disagreements, queries, or suggestions for things that we could talk about on the podcast in the future. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. Otherwise, do look at Dad's website, johnwyatt.com. Mine is tswyatt.com. And don't forget to sign up to my Critical Friends weekly church news newsletter on Substack as well. That's enough self-promotion. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.